This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. In the Arizona desert, towering saguaro cacti sway ever so slightly, so quiet, in fact, that most of us never even notice. But to University of Utah geologist Dr. Jeff Moore, those subtle movements hold a hidden story. Moore has taken the tools he normally uses to study rock arches and cliffs and turned them toward botany, uncovering how these giant cacti bend, flex, and respond to the vibrations of the world around them. On Cool Science Radio today, we explore how a non-invasive seismology-based technique is revealing the secret biomechanics of saguaros without harming a single spine. Joining me on the show today is Dr. Jeff Moore. He is, again, a University of Utah geologist who specializes in geohazard monitoring and natural structure vibration. He brings decades of experience from the University of Utah, UC Berkeley, and Switzerland to this unusual intersection of seismology and botany. Dr. Jeff Moore, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks. That was a really good summary.
Well, I had to get it all in there so our listeners could grasp this rather unusual, crazy intersection between the arches and cliffs in southern Utah and what their seismic response is and how it all relates to the saguaro cactus.
Yeah, so, you know, I spent the last sort of 10 years here at the University of Utah studying vibration of rock structures. I'm a geologist by training and had been developing a set of tools to try to assess changing structural health of rock features, assess their vibration properties to do some mechanical and structural characterization. But I was visiting family in Tucson. I'm originally from Tucson. I was visiting family and realized that this sort of set of tools that I've been developing and analysis techniques I've been developing could also be applied to saguaro cacti. So saguaro are not unlike a rock tower or a tall building in the way that their vibration properties can sometimes follow an expected analytical trend that, you know, mirrors a type of beam we call a cantilever. So a cantilever is just a beam that's fixed on one end. Mm-hmm. And we have a very like tidy set of analytical expressions for a cantilever system. And in rock towers, I explored that area and found that they do indeed like vibrate much like a cantilever. So I thought, okay, well, here's a saguaro cactus. You know, when they grow very, very slowly, of course. And, you know, by decades, they, you know, might be the height of a human. And by 100 years, they could be, you know, several meters tall. And then only after that do they develop arms. So until they develop arms, they are very much like a cantilever, just a single stem saguaro cactus. Sometimes call that a spear. And so I thought, okay, well, you know, let's just explore this area and find out what I can about the biomechanics now of these cactus stems. Using my tools in my seismology tools to, you know, investigate, uncover these sort of internal mechanical properties.
Wow. So when you talk about seismology tools, I'm wondering about the specific movement that you would chart either in rocks or in these giant saguaro cacti. What comes first, the vibration and then the movement, or the movement creates the vibration, or how does it work?
So the saguaros, like rock towers and other objects I've studied, are constantly in motion. So, you know, we very well know that when the wind picks up, then the saguaro shakes strongly and vice versa. But even when there's no wind, the cactus is still in motion. And that's because the roots are of course, you know, connected with the earth, and the earth is alive with seismic energy at all times. And so it's this seismic energy that's going to excite vibration of the cactus, even in the absence of wind. Of course, when the wind picks up, then it can vibrate strongly. And in the case of strong winds, that can actually topple the cactus. That's one of the main ways that saguaro actually are killed, by strong winds. So they're always in motion. And it's just like rock structures, but it's just then up to me to come in and sample that motion, to measure that motion. And so luckily now we have very sensitive seismometers that are both inexpensive and lightweight. I don't think I could have done this study, maybe 20 years ago. Or if I were to do it, I would have had to excite vibration on my own. That's shake the cactus on my own, which is generally not something that I ever want to do. So I have these lightweight seismometers. They're actually something that's called a Raspberry Shake. It's built off a Raspberry Pi, little computer board. And then it has in it three sensors that measure three components of ground motion, three mutually orthogonal components of ground motion, so up, down, and then two horizontals. And I needed to then get that onto the cactus, which is a little bit of a weird part to do. So I built this little bracket, just 3D printed this little bracket, and then the seismometer has to be leveled. So it just rests then on this bracket, and then the bracket is strapped to the cactus. So this is a bit silly when you're out, in the desert with some kind of nylon strap and a bracket, and just, the thorns themselves on the outside of the cactus are, an inch long. So they're sticking through the strap and all kinds of, they're in my hands and all kinds of silly things. But I strapped a little bracket onto the cactus and then put the seismometer on. And then for most of the measurements I did, I just left it there for 15 minutes. And during that time, I'd just go, I don't know, 10 feet away and sit down. And not move. If I would move around, the instrument would record my walking around, and it would be in the data. It wouldn't ruin anything, but it's better to have quiet data. So I would just go and sit down and let it run for 15 minutes, ambient vibration data, and then go and turn it off and take the strap off the cactus and move on to the next one. And like this, I did 10 in a day. It got a little repetitive after a while, and it got a little disorienting, but I was able to move pretty quickly through that. And again, like you mentioned, the big advantage of this is this, it's a really non-destructive way. It's just a strap goes on, and then it comes off, and there should be no damage to the cactus.
Okay, so this is a really interesting world of seismology. So I'm picturing, well, let me ask you this. What were they developed for? Were they actually developed to, be strapped onto delicate arch or Fisher Tower? Or were they initially developed to chart and to gather information about buildings and their seismic response? Because that's what it would seem to me would be a very important application.
Yeah, I mean, so these are all instruments that were developed for earthquake detection, monitoring, earthquake location, and determining earthquake magnitude. So I use two different types of instruments mainly in my research. I use a very expensive, ultra-sensitive seismometer, which we use for rock arches. And that works great. It's really high-end thing and amazing. It's a little bit heavier though. And when I went to Swarovski, I wanted something that was as light as possible. So that's where the Raspberry Shake comes in. And this Raspberry Shake is an interesting device. It's a citizen science instrument almost. They sell these. They cost, I don't know, about $1,000. And they sell these to individuals or schools that want to participate in earthquake monitoring. So the instrument's set up like that. You can deploy it in your basement and plug it into the internet, and it'll automatically start sending data to this network. So it's quite a cool device, but we've done extensive testing on it. We can use it at other sites, on our arch sites as well, and compared it to our more expensive instruments, and it works fine. It has some limitations which didn't, affect this study, but the main thing is that it was lightweight.
Oh, what a great concept and interesting that people would love their own sort of DIY seismology device. Okay, so Raspberry Shake, it's called. Where does it get its name from?
Yeah, so it's built off of what's called a Raspberry Pi, which is a little computer on a chip device, and Raspberry Pis are used all over for all kinds of interesting purposes. It's an inexpensive computer, and then so then the company build, they build their own board that goes interfaces with that, and then the three geophones go together in this case from that. So yeah, that's it. I mean, and we use these devices for monitoring all kinds of things. We have a couple even installed at the moment on Native American cliff dwelling sites on masonry walls, monitoring vibration there as well.
Wow. If you're just joining me on Cool Science Radio, I'm having a conversation with University of Utah geologist Dr. Jeff Moore. He hails from the Tucson area, and he's had what I'm assuming is a lifelong interest in saguaro, in the saguaro cactus. And we're talking about measuring the seismic action and the vibration of the saguaro. So that in and of itself, Jeff, is really interesting. But I'm also imagining our listeners and myself for certain thinking, I've never thought about movement and vibration on one of our arches in southern Utah or one of the towers. It only makes sense, but I mean, I'm really curious about that as well. We think of, oh gosh, which was the arch that had a piece fall off of it? And there was a great video of it. It was about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago. I can't think of it now. But someone grabbed a video of it and a little piece of it fell off. So we think about erosion, we think about water and, wind, but not as it relates to seismology. So I think that's really interesting in and of itself. I mean, is that what contributes to when these towers and arches fall over?
Yeah, I mean that was one of our main sort of motivating questions in this overall project. It's really a twofold approach. On the one hand, the motivation for studying the vibration of rock arches and towers was structural health monitoring. So to provide a method of generating data that helps us understand structural changes within the arch. And for example, it might be landscape arch you're talking about, where it was in the 90s and a big slab buckled off the bottom of it explosively. And there was, and it came crashing down. At the time, the trail used to run under landscape arch, and it's super dramatic and amazingly huge underneath. But at the time, then the Park Service closed the trail because they didn't know that it was safe. And so it's these kind of questions, is the arch experiencing, really rapid damage, and could it collapse, or is it, does there no changes, structural changes? So it's quite a hard question to answer. So one of our main motivations was to provide some data for that kind of question. It's structural health monitoring data. But the other aspect of it, as you mentioned, is vibration damage itself and vibration risk assessments, if you like, for these features. And those vibration sources can come from natural things like wind or earthquakes, but they can also have anthropogenic sources like foot traffic, road traffic, and something that arose part of our research, which is really interesting, is helicopters as well. So helicopters emit infrasound. You can't hear it, but it's the strongest sound they produce. And they emit this from their main rotors. And this infrasound, if the infrasound frequency coincides with the natural frequency of an arch, a wall, a cactus, a tree, then it will cause resonance and it will cause that feature to vibrate strongly. And so this is something that's come up quite a lot. People are concerned, that nearby helicopter flight can cause strong vibration of lots of different kinds of features.
Yeah, well, I think about that sort of new helicopter business just outside in between Virgin and Springdale down near Zion Park. And all the, there are a lot of limits on helicopters flying over national parks.
Yes and no, interestingly. I mean, so there is a big effort to make air tour agreements between or having the parks like set air tour limits. But many people don't know that the parks don't regulate the airspace over the parks. So To my understanding, their power is limited. You know, if they want to, if somebody is flying and they want to say, "Hey, please don't do that," they,
Right.
yeah.
So again, going back to things that we consider so powerful that contribute to the degradation of, whether it is a canyon wall in Zion Canyon or a tower, an arch, or a saguaro cactus, what would be the strongest? I mean, is this kind of these vibrations that are created by things like the sound coming out of a helicopter that we can't even hear? On what scale would that be present? When you compare it to something like water, something like
Yeah.
that.
So, okay. A very common natural source is wind, and
Yeah.
that sometimes that's strong, and that's something that's really affecting all of these all the time, I'd say. Uncommon but strong are earthquakes, and those can have, varying recurrence intervals, and sometimes humans affect those recurrence intervals. For example, down near Moab, there's a wastewater injection site managed by the Bureau of Reclamation, just over the border in Colorado that generates earthquakes. Sorry,
Wait,
I got a
before you
little.
go on, generates earthquakes to what
Hello.
degree on the Richter scale?
Yeah, so in March of 2019, there was a magnitude 4.6 earthquake that was created from wastewater injection at the site. This is a paradox. Valley. It's again, it's just over the border into Colorado near the La Salle Mountains. But this is the Bureau of Reclamation Bedrock, I think it's called. Wait, it's a saltwater injection facility. So it intercepts water headed towards the Colorado that's flowing across the Paradox Basin. And it's if that water's too salty, if it gets to the Colorado, then it could make the Colorado River water too salty. And so, in order to prevent that, they inject a lot of it underground. So this generated strong ground vibration that was felt in Moab. And if you think about the earthquake, the seismic setting of the region, it's not common to have earthquakes of that magnitude in the region. So this is an uncommon new stress for the region. But we got I got off topic.
Sorry, that tangent was my doing. That's very interesting, though. I had no idea that that sort of saltwater injection went on. But what I was asking you about was the degrees to which various triggers contribute to the degradation of structures and surfaces. Where does something seemingly innocuous, like a helicopter vibration that we can't even hear. Where does that fall in on the scale?
That's right. So we have strong events which are sort of singular but rare, like an earthquake, and then we have something like a helicopter, which a single flight itself does not necessarily generate a strongly and potentially damaging shaking, unless it's super close, and I can touch on that in a second. But generally, these are difficult kind of sources to analyze because they're exciting moderate to low level vibrations, but in some instances, in some places, they can be doing it very frequently. So it's an added stress which is not itself particularly large, but it can be frequent. And then it becomes one of these questions, okay, what are the effects over a year or over 10 years or over 50 years? Is this, something that has like kind of a large accumulating effect? And that's where our analysis took us, was this cumulative effects over long periods of time for things like helicopters and things like road traffic. Just cars and trucks on the roads generate ground vibrations, which can excite residents of nearby arches or Native American structures, for example.
Well, it's really interesting then because I think I read that the oldest saguaro cactus is something like was 300 years old, and they typically live to like 150 to 200 years old. And if you talk about these vibrations and the seismic activity surrounding things like saguaro cacti and also our arches and what else? What else?
There was a case back in the 90s where folks were investigating this very influence of helicopters on vibration of Native American cliff dwelling walls at Mesa Verde. And to do that, then they chartered a helicopter and just, monitored a wall and flew the helicopter really close. Well, once the helicopter got pretty close in and was hovering at the level of the structure, that it was generating ground or generating vibrations of the wall that are akin to, a magnitude 4 earthquake. So something quite large, which we can immediately recognize that could be potentially damaging. And they did, and they stopped the test immediately once they measured that. So in the sort of extreme conditions of a very close flight, then the vibrations can be potentially quite large.
Okay, so going from seismology to botany, you might think that in order to measure the vibration and sort of the movement of a saguaro cactus, you might start by strapping one of these raspberry shakes on, say, an oak tree or an aspen tree and make a comparison. But it's all really interesting, and I guess it takes me back to the question of why. I mean, I know you're really into the saguaro cactus, but what questions does it answer for you as a geologist or as a botanist?
Yeah, so I had two big motivations going into this. The first is a structural characterization motivation. So if you want to do any analysis of what kind of forces it'll take to topple a saguaro, or how a saguaro will behave if there's a strong windstorm, or what happens if that windstorm happens when it's also a drought and the cactus is water depleted, you need mechanical parameters of the cactus itself, and you need what's called flexural stiffness. And in the past, the only way they could get this was by physically cutting out portions of the stem and attaching weights to them and measuring how much it bends. So this is how this is obviously something that is done very rarely. Saguaro are protected, and we need those parameters. But nobody wants to damage the cactus. So a big motivation was to identify a non-destructive way to get this mechanical properties. And then another big motivation was a structural monitoring motivation. So the resonance frequencies of any system, whether it's rock or tissue and wood and pith and all the stuff, is a function of mass and stiffness. So if the frequencies change, then one of those two parameters is changing, mass or stiffness. So in a saguaro, mass can change if it takes up a bunch of water, for example, in a monsoon storm. Or the stiffness can change if, for example, the material somehow, the inner material of the cactus is sensitive to temperatures, for example. So it can get, warmer or softer. It can get softer or stiffer during the day and nighttime. Or if it gets diseased. If it gets diseased, we know that the interior of the pith begins to rot and even begins to liquefy. So there's all kinds of changes, that could potentially be monitored with this approach, which is again at the core non-destructive.
Okay, so I would imagine that a well-hydrated saguaro is going to be more flexible than a dehydrated one, or do I have that wrong?
Well, I can tell you I don't necessarily know that either. So I did a test and I thought, okay, well, my main hypothesis was saguaro, if the saguaro takes up a bunch of water, the mass is going to increase, the resonant frequency is going to decrease. I'm going to be able to measure that. And so we did a test, and I actually had my dad help me do this test. We put the instrument on the saguaro for 2 weeks. For 10 days, nothing. Just nothing happened. It was just going along, just nominal ambient conditions. Then we put a bunch of water, we sprinkled a bunch of water on the ground, representing about an inch accumulation in like 20, 30 minutes, kind of like a big storm. And so I thought, okay, well, the saguaro is going to grab that water, it's going to drink it up, and there's a lot of water available, and I'm really going to measure this. And I didn't measure any change.
Oh.
Now, I think, I'm pretty sure that's because I did the experiment in March when the saguaro simply, it had come out of like the winter season. This is not like when a saguaro really is stressed for water and needs to take up the water. So I should have done that experiment, in July or August, and maybe we'll repeat that. But in the meantime, what we were seeing was that the resonance frequencies changed quite noticeably, I don't want to say dramatically, they changed a lot between the day and night, and up to like 20%. So if the water content of the cactus isn't necessarily changing by that much between day and night, then what's happening is that actually the stem tissue is changing properties, it's changing stiffness. So we are able to sensitively measure changes. I just don't, have the background to tell you exactly what they relate to. It's just, the cactus stem is getting softer during the day as it warms, and it's getting stiffer at night as it cools. And that could be something very simple, just relating to the Young's modulus of the pith. But saguaros do interesting things. They respire at night to bring in CO2 only at night. They only breathe in at night, and then they store the CO2 as acid, which is then used in photosynthesis during the day. I don't know. It was a very blind experiment for me, through and through, which was kind of an interesting way to do it. I didn't have any botany background, so I just, coming into this blind and using sort of the analytical framework of a cantilever, a beam theory, to help me interpret what was going on in the cactus. And then a lot of things, especially with the structural characterization part, began to make sense. So one of the things that we see from the data was essentially that taller stems are stiffer. And for a single stem, it's stiffest at the bottom and softest at the top. And that kind of, thing coming out from the data was clear and a little bit perplexing at first. I thought, what is that? And then I just remembered, okay, I've seen saguaro ribs on the ground, and so the saguaro, I should say, has this really unique internal morphology where it has these ribs which run the length of the stem from the bottom to the top, and they provide the main like flexural s stiffness. The main strength of a cactus and the stiffness is with these wooden ribs. And then they can kind of expand and contract if they need to allow the cactus to expand to take up more water.
Dr. Jeff Moore, geologist and possibly now botanist from the University of Utah. It's been really interesting talking with you today, and I hope our listeners have learned a lot, as I have, about the saguaro cactus. And most notably, what's hitting home for me is the fact that you are doing this research in large part trying to figure out a way to learn more while still protecting the saguaro. As we know, it's a protected species because it provides a lot of habitat in the desert, but also because it takes so long to grow. Jeff, thank you so much for joining me on Cool Science Radio, and best of luck.
Thanks, Lynn.